On one very cold and cloudy Saturday morning, January 15th, 1929, Alberta Williams King and her husband, the Reverend Martin Luther King Sr., gave birth to their first child. They named him Martin after his father. In his lifetime, little Martin Luther King Jr. would change the way people understood democracy, religion, race relations, and human relations throughout the entire world. Young Martin grew up in a relatively middle-class home, but in a very segregated Atlanta, Georgia. Though he never wanted for food or clothing, he knew that whenever he walked out of his door into white America, he would always be considered colored, and therefore always second class. Here are some of his own reflections on what it was like to grow up in a segregated world.
Growing up a Negro in America is not a comfortable existence. It means being part of the company of the bruised, the battered, the scarred, and the defeated. Being a Negro in America means trying to smile when you want to cry. It means trying to hold on to physical life amid psychological death. It means the pain of watching your own children grow up with clouds of inferiority in their mental skies. It means having your legs cut off and then being condemned for being a cripple. It means seeing your mother and father spiritually murdered by the slings and arrows of daily exploitation, and then being hated for being an orphan. Being a Negro in America means listening to suburban politicians talk eloquently against open housing while arguing in the same breath that they are not racists. It means being harried by day and haunted by night by a nagging sense of nobodyness and constantly fighting to be saved from the poison of bitterness. It means the ache and anguish of living in so many situations where hopes unborn have died.
When he graduated from high school, King went on to Morehouse College in Atlanta, then Crozier Seminary in Pennsylvania. There he made straight A's and received a scholarship to go into graduate school, earning a PhD from Boston University's School of Theology. In Boston, he met a young woman named Coretta Christine Scott, who was a graduate student at the New England Conservatory of Music. At first, he was unsure about her because he'd heard that she wasn't too religious. And she was unsure about him because she had heard that he was too short. But after they got to know one another, he grew to believe that her faith was not showy, but deeper on the inside than anyone's he'd ever known. And as for her concerns, he never grew any taller on the outside, but on the inside, he became a giant. And on June 18, 1953, they were married. April 1954, King accepted the call to serve the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. May 17, 1954, the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education ruled that racial segregation of public schools was unconstitutional. November 17, 1954, their first child, Yolanda, was born. And on December 1st, as he was making plans for a series of sermons on the coming of the Christ child at Christmas, that same time, a black seamstress in Montgomery named Rosa Parks, after a long day of work, refused to give up her seat to a white man on a bus. She had taken the first seat in the colored section of the back of the bus, but the bus filled up, and by law, whites could demand that any black person give up their seat at any time. She had done so before, but today she was tired. She also thought to herself that the Supreme Court had just desegregated the public schools, so if desegregation is good enough for children, it's good enough for adults. So she refused to give up her seat. The bus driver called the police, who arrested her, and the town exploded. Blacks were wanting to riot, and whites were wanting to kill blacks who wanted to riot. The black community elected a young father, young preacher, young seminary graduate, Martin Luther King, Jr., to organize them to respond to the crisis. Over 2,000 people rallied in front of a church that night to decide what they would do. The air was tense and explosive. It was a dangerous night for both blacks and whites. Dr. King stood up to speak to them that night. This is some of what he said.
"We are here this evening for serious business. We're here in a general sense because first and foremost, we are American citizens, and we are determined to acquire our citizenship to the fullness of its meaning. We are here also because of our deep-seated belief that democracy transformed from thin paper to thick action is the greatest form of government on earth. But in our protest, there will be no cross-burnings. No white person will be taken from his home by a hooded Negro mob and brutally murdered. There will be no threats and intimidation. We will be guided by the highest principles of law and order, the deepest principles of our Christian faith. Love must be our regulating ideal. If we fail to do this, our protest will end up being as a meaningless drama on the stage of history, and its memory will be shrouded with the ugly garments of shame. In spite of the mistreatment that we have confronted, we must not become bitter and end up by hating our white brothers. Let no people pull you down so low as to make you hate them."
So instead of a riot, they organized a boycott of the Montgomery bus system, with carpools taking people to work. Nonviolently, they brought the city to its knees. The city took them all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing for segregation. And finally, after over a year of attacks and threats and thousands of daily hate letters and phone calls, after his home was bombed and the police refused to investigate, and after King himself was arrested and jailed twice for speeding and had to pay hundreds of dollars in fines and had his auto insurance policy revoked, after the movement had to spend tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees and bail, after all this and more, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that segregation of public transportation facilities was unconstitutional. King and his movement became internationally famous after that. Together with Ralph Abernathy and others, they founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, began organizing voter registration throughout the South. At that time, less than 10% of blacks in America were registered to vote. And in most cases in the South, they were not allowed to register. In 1964, black college students in Greensboro, North Carolina, went into a whites-only department store, sat down at the lunch counter, and waited to be served. They were arrested, but they took it to court, and a nationwide protest movement called sit-ins began. In October 1960, Reverend King and several others joined in a sit-in in Atlanta, demanding to be served food just like the whites were. They, too, were arrested. Later, all but King were freed, for he was found to be, quote, on parole for a traffic violation. And he was sentenced to 4 months of hard labor in the Reidsville State Prison, the harshest maximum security facility in the South. While in prison wearing leg irons, eating rancid food in an unheated room infested with bugs, Martin wrote this letter to his wife, Coretta.
"Hello, darling. Today I find myself a long way from you and the children. I know this whole experience is very difficult for you to adjust to, especially in your condition of pregnancy. But as I said to you yesterday, this is the cross that we must bear for the freedom of our people. I have the faith to believe that this excessive suffering that is now coming to our family will in some little way serve to make Atlanta a better city, Georgia a better state, and America a better country. Just how, I do not know yet, but I have faith to believe it will. If I am correct, then our suffering is not in vain. I understand that everybody, white and colored, can have visitors this coming Sunday, I hope you can find some way to come down. Give my best regards to all the family. Please ask them not to worry about me. I will adjust to whatever pain comes. Hope to see you next Sunday. Eternally yours, Martin.
But King did not spend the full 4 months in prison. As it happened, a young U.S. senator and presidential candidate named John F. Kennedy personally called the judge who had sentenced him and talked him into reversing his decision. The reputation of Martin Luther King and the movement grew larger and larger through the early 60s. King increasingly began to see that the struggle was no longer just for civil rights, but for human rights. For when one part of humanity is held down, then all of humanity is harmed and made less because of it. Perhaps the turning point in his life and the life of the movement took place in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama. In those days, Birmingham was arguably the most oppressive and thoroughly segregated city in the nation. It had such a long history of brutality and violence against its black citizens that it was known by some as the American Johannesburg. The homes of blacks in one section of town were bombed by whites so often that it got the name Dynamite Hill. Birmingham was so bad that it banned a children's storybook about friendly white and black rabbits. It also banned what they called race music on white stations. By that they meant Ray Charles. King once said that about the only thing in town that both blacks and whites shared together were the streets and the sewer system. The police commissioner of Birmingham was Eugene Bull Connor. He was an angry, forceful racist who openly bragged about how many blacks he had beaten and killed in his lifetime. He promised that, quote, blood would run in the streets before Birmingham would desegregate its public facilities. So on April 3rd, 1963, the protests in Birmingham began with boycotts, lunch counter sit-ins, and daily marches, all done quietly and calmly, completely nonviolently. Bull Connor began arresting protesters, but hundreds more came. Over the weeks, the Birmingham jail had over 3,000 people in it, and yet more came. King himself was one of those arrested early in the marches. King spent the next 10 days running the campaign from the Birmingham jail. While there, he had been given a newspaper in which a number of white clergy, Christian and Jewish, had written a public letter criticizing him for pushing integration too quickly. King sat down in his cell, and on pieces of newspaper, rags, toilet tissue, and the backs of envelopes, he wrote a public response. His response became known as the Letter from the Birmingham Jail, and has become one of the most famous statements about nonviolent civil disobedience written in that century. Here's just a portion of what he wrote.
My dear fellow clergymen, while confined here in Birmingham Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. Since I feel that you are men of genuine goodwill and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I want to try to answer your statement in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. You told us that our protests were untimely and that we should wait and trust you. For centuries, the Negro has heard wait, and wait has nearly always meant never. We have waited for more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will, and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, When you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers and sisters smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering, as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, "Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean?" When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored. When your first name becomes nigger and your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title of Mrs. When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments, when you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait.
Outside, Bull Connor had firefighters turn fire hoses on the marchers, sending columns of water crashing into children and adults, knocking them over, ripping their clothing, smashing them against the sides of buildings, bloodying their bodies, sweeping them off the streets. He released dogs trained to attack and bite and tear at running people. Day after day, television cameras showed a shocked world these horrors. And day after day, the carnage continued, and day after day, the marchers continued marching for freedom. The turning point occurred on Sunday, May 5th, 1963, when 3,000 children went on a prayer vigil to the Birmingham jail where King and others were being held. When they arrived, the police threatened the children and screamed at them, but all the children did was kneel and begin to pray. Finally, one of the protesters stood up from his prayer and said to them, "We're not turning back. We haven't done anything wrong. All we want is our freedom." How do you feel doing these things? Bull Connor yelled at his men to turn on the hoses, but nobody moved. The children continued praying. His men were silent. He yelled again, but they dropped their fire hoses. One of the firemen began to cry. Another said, "We can't continue to do this." The children continued praying silently. No one spoke again, and nobody got hurt. And soon after that, the businesses of Birmingham finally agreed to integrate. Well, the next few years were a whirlwind. In the space of just 1 year, the Supreme Court ruled that segregation in Birmingham was unconstitutional. King led a successful 125,000-person walk for freedom in Detroit. King was invited to have an audience with the Pope. He received the Nobel Prize for Peace. He was named Time Magazine's Man of the Year. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And on August 28, 1963, King was the featured speaker at the largest civil rights demonstration in history in Washington, D.C. The words of his dream still echo across America.
I say to you today, my friends, even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom to ring, we will let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city. We will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of that old spiritual, Negro spiritual, free at last, thank God Almighty, we're free at last.
Over the next few years, King grew to believe that race was only one of the issues at the core of America's problems. Violence and America's general disregard for the poor seemed to him to be issues larger than race, so for the summer of 1968, he planned to hold the biggest march on Washington ever. This time, the march would not be specifically about black people or civil rights, but also about poverty. He called it the Poor People's Campaign. But in the midst of planning for the Poor People's Campaign, he was asked to come to Memphis, Tennessee, to lend support to striking sanitation workers. He agreed to go, even though his schedule was brutal, he was too tired, too busy, and he was catching the flu. By the time he arrived in Memphis, he had grown so ill he was unable to prepare a formal speech and tried to beg off speaking at a pre-strike rally. So his friend Ralph Abernathy agreed to address the group instead. But when he got to the church, he found 2,000 people clamoring to hear Dr. King speak, not Mr. Abernathy. So Abernathy went to a phone and called King, saying that if he had any energy left, could he come out to these people and at least say a few words to them? King drove to the church that night in a driving rain, stumbled weakly to the podium, and without notes or manuscript or any idea of what he was about to say, he delivered what has become known as the "I've been to the mountaintop" speech. This is some of what he said on April 3rd, 1968.
It is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It is nonviolence or non-existence. I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And God's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing anyone. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
The next day, April 4th, 1968, King, Abernathy, several others spent most of the day in their room at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis planning for the big event of the next few days regarding the sanitation workers' strike. Around 5, they all began to change clothes and get ready to go to the home of a local pastor who had invited them all for dinner. 6:05 that evening, Martin Luther King and Andrew Young, Jesse Jackson, and several others were standing on the second floor balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. The car that was to drive them pulled up, and Dr. King recognized the driver as the young man who was scheduled to sing in the program following dinner that night. King yelled down to him, "Ben, Make sure you do Precious Lord Take My Hand at the meeting tonight. And sing it real pretty. And Ben yelled back, okay, Doc, I will. Just then the sound of a shot rang out. King slammed backward against the wall of the balcony and then fell forward onto the balcony. Ralph Abernathy rushed out to him. Someone else found a pillow to put under his head. A Secret Service agent held a towel to the wound in his neck to try to stop the bleeding. During the next few minutes, Ralph Abernathy held the head of his dearest, closest friend in his lap while waiting for the ambulance to arrive, watching the life bleed out of him. He spoke to Martin several times during those minutes, but Martin could only respond with his eyes. Years later, Abernathy said that he heard much from those eyes that night. Martin Luther King looked at him very awake and very alert, and with his eyes, he seemed to be speaking very clearly. He was saying, Ralph, it isn't over. It's only in other people's hands now. Don't give up. Never give up. Never give up. And then he died.
The legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is awe-inspiring, global in scope, humbling, enduring. We remember his life and we think to ourselves, but of course he could be that brave. Of course he could be patient. Of course he could be so inspirational. He was Martin Luther King Jr. Yes, he was. But he was a person like you and me, with faith in the same God we trust. The question for our day, the question for each of us, is this. How will we embody the teachings of Jesus as personally and as powerfully and as persistently as Martin Luther King Jr.?